And for more on the news out of Zimbabwe, we turn to our reporters' roundtable. With us, Kevin Merida, associate editor of The Washington Post. He's also editor of the book Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. Corey Dade, Atlanta correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and Derek McGinty, news anchor at WUSA 9 in Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
So let's keep going with Zimbabwe first. By law, the Electoral Commission is supposed to release results within 6 days of voting. That means today. So the ruling party, and this is evolving very quickly, is calling for a runoff, which should happen if no candidate won more than 50% of the vote. But they're not actually releasing the results of the vote. So let me start with you, Kevin. How do you think the coverage of this election will and should unfold from here? And will the media attention internationally shape the fairness or unfairness of this process?
Well, you're continuing to get more of a focus on the media coverage. And I think because, you know, Robert Mugabe is such a large figure in Africa. I mean, he's one of the figures that people recognize. And I hate to draw these parallels to Idi Amin and Mobutu Sese Seko and others who have gone, but I think that he's kind of one of the last towering figures. You know, you see that much of Africa has moved toward democratic government more and more, and that's been very difficult. And a lot of times it has taken really these crisis moments to really focus world attention on some of the troubling electoral problems. You saw the same thing that happened in Kenya. So, you know, I think it is going to kind of work against the Mugabe ruling party, and I think the spotlight will continue to shine brightly.
Corey, again, this story is evolving, but ZANU-PF, the ruling party, now says that the opposition party bribed electoral officials. It's contesting 16 parliamentary seats. That would be enough to give ZANU-PF the majority again, which apparently it had lost. So, if there's allegations of vote rigging on either side, do you think the international community is going to step in on this one? And you know, putting this in the context of this being an African nation which fought its way to liberation, but then slipped into what appears to be a dictatorship, where do you think the international community is going to line up on this one?
Well, I think that the international community from a distance would certainly advocate free and fair and open elections and a lawful exchange transition of power if it comes to that. I think what it will take is an honest broker in the form of, say, for example, Jimmy Carter or other humanitarians who have made it their business to go in and try to be an honest broker when it comes to elections. I think the role of news media there can also play a part. International media can try, at least, to play a role in reporting this in the best way possible so that you do shine a light on the process. To the extent that you can shine a light on the process, that's the extent, that may be the extent to which you get international intervention.
And Derek, the journalists are now becoming part of the story. We just heard from Precious Shumba. He's a local journalist, and it's risky for him to do his job. But also, some of the international journalists have been taken into custody for allegedly violating the country's journalism laws. One of them is Barry Barak, a Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for The New York Times. When you're dealing with a government that doesn't want international reporters, you know, how should journalists make a decision? You know, okay, well, maybe it's illegal for me to report, but I have to do it anyway. Is that something that, journalists need to just say?
Well,
go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, you heard from your friend Precious Shumba that, you know, it was an act of cowardice if he were to leave his country. And I think, look, a couple of things. First of all, in the age of the internet, it's very difficult to do what leaders like Mugabe have done over the years, which is quash the press just by sheer force of will and law and use the armed forces to make sure that the news doesn't get out. I mean, it's almost impossible to do it that way anymore because the news is ubiquitous and the internet is ubiquitous. But I think the key thing we should watch here is what we seem to see is a sort of a push and pull within the Mugabe administration such that it is. I mean, you heard from some that there's some negotiations going on with generals as to how he would leave. On the other end, you have hardliners who say he absolutely is not leaving. He's going to stay in power. This man is 84 years old. So time itself is going to take him out of power before too long. You have to wonder how much of the resistance comes from those who benefit from his regime being in power as much as it comes from himself.
Kevin, what significance does this story have in the U.S.? And I mean, I say that with, you know, all due respect, Americans may not always be the most plugged into international events, but this has a lot of different elements. There's race, there's colonialism, there's, you know, power, all of these things that make stories sexy. What interest do you think Americans have in an election like this?
Well, I think regrettably, there's not the high level of interest. I mean, I think that, you know, we have had a very narrow focus when it comes to African coverage from a U.S. perspective. I think that, you know, you see a lot of coverage when there are a conflict, like in Somalia, or when, particularly when there's U.S. involvement. But we've missed some big stories. I mean, it took, you know, you relate to famine, some of the famine stories in Ethiopia and in Sudan. We relate coming to the Rwandan crisis and genocide. And I think that our attention as Americans tends to be focused on, you know, the kind of desperation of the people that's exhibited when you see, you know, famine and genocide, but I think less so in political crisis.
Well, Kevin, can I, this is Derek McKinney, just ask a quick question. I mean, wouldn't you say there's some level of, I don't want to call it strongman fatigue? I mean, you pointed out that Mugabe is sort of the last of the African strongmen, and Americans may feel like we've heard this story before. He's either going to stay in or he's not. How does it affect me? I mean, these are the kind of issues you have to deal with as a newspaper man, aren't they?
No, I think you're exactly right. I mean, and we have gotten involved in some of these conflicts, not to draw a parallel, but in the case with Aristide. I mean, you know, we got involved in that. First, he's in our country. Then he's back over in Haiti. And there's always a sense that it's someone else's problem, that the U.S. Doesn't need to be involved in the internal politics. And particularly, I think, of a black nations. I think there's much less interest. If this were happening in some other places, I think there would be more interest.
I want to transition us to the biggest story in the U.S. today, which is the 40th anniversary of the death of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Corey, how do you feel? What was the highlight for you this week in terms of coverage, you know, either by your organization or anyone else of this momentous anniversary?
Well, Farai, I'm here in Atlanta, so the coverage is continuing. And this is obviously home base for the King family, for Martin Luther King, and certainly the civil rights movement. So that continues. I would say that so far, what struck me personally was an editorial that Kevin's own newspaper ran earlier this week that was an excerpt from an editorial run 2 days after King was assassinated. And it talked about, it looked forward and it was rather prophetic. It talked about the fact that blacks looting and rioting after his death can more easily be forgiven for that than can whites. Because whites have either been actively or passively involved in the discrimination of blacks since slavery. And so moving forward, even once whites become, quote unquote, honest, you know, sort of fair and honest brokers and dealers with African Americans, they will be on a certain type of probation for many, many years. And I think that what's interesting about that is that has been the case. And I don't know that our public consciousness has really kept that in discourse. But I think going forward here in Atlanta, it's very interesting. I think every news organization, certainly in this area, the churches, the entire community here are pulling out the stops in more creative ways. You're seeing, you know, the testimonials like you had on the earlier part of the show. And also I went to a screening last night of a new documentary on King that was narrated by Tom Brokaw. And I think that given that race has been kind of brought back into the public discourse by the Democratic presidential race, the nomination phase of it, I think certainly here in Atlanta, there is a greater sensitivity by all, black, white, no matter what your race is, to the issue of race. And I think I'm seeing kind of a higher absorption rate of the seriousness of where the country is as a result of this anniversary date.
Kevin, Corey just brought up the presidential race. Of course, Barack Obama, a lot of people have been saying that he is in some ways the fruit of the bitter times the Reverend King death marked. Do you see it that way? Do you see us turning a corner in America?
Well, certainly Barack Obama is really the first African leader, certainly politician, embraced so widely by so many different people on a national scale. And I think that speaks to a certain extraordinary progress, but it also speaks to some of his own gifts. And I think when you're looking at Dr. King, we look at him, you know, kind of in the rearview mirror. And in that sense, King looks really amazing. At the time, he was under siege. He was unpopular. He battled for a lot of unpopular causes, including the Vietnam War, and the upliftment of poor people. And he got a lot of flack. He was, the Black Power movement either embraced it or repudiated. And he was living in dangerous times. And so I think that, if you look at what he was able to achieve, and then you transfer to the times now with Barack Obama, and you've seen some of the same parallels. I mean, he's walking a very difficult line. He gets under fire because of what his minister Jeremiah Wright said. If you were to go back and review some of the speeches that Dr. King had, you would see some of the same fiery, tough rhetoric, harshness against government that was exhibited in Wright's speeches. So I see a lot of interesting parallels from those times to the times we have today.
And Derek, what about, you know, just the basics, money? You know, Dr. King ended his life on this note of trying to deal with poverty. And today we hear some really disturbing statistics about Black economics. I mean, how much have things changed?
Well, you know, there was an interesting editorial. You mentioned editorial in the Washington Post. There was a piece by Eugene Robinson in the paper today basically saying that you got to really look at how much has really changed since then. That while at the time, 40% of African Americans were poor. Now, just 20% are poor, but they are more entrenched in poverty than they were then. I mean, so many are more middle class. So many more make $100,000 than did in 1968 or whatever. But those that are left, it seems, are much more hopeless. And we see the fruit of that in the violence and the struggle that goes on every day that seems so much more intractable and difficult to solve than it was maybe 40 years ago.
Any final thoughts briefly, Derek?
Well, you know, on the King situation, I just want to bring this up. First of all, the man was so brilliant. And I think that's the thing that has been left out of the conversation about Dr. King. If you go back and read what he wrote, if you read the letter from the Birmingham jail, even if you read some of his later speeches on the Vietnam War and on the things that, as was just mentioned, made him somewhat unpopular at the time, his intelligence, I think sheer genius shines through. And we just don't talk about that so much. You know, he had a doctorate. He had a degree from very competitive universities at the time, which almost, you know, very few African-Americans had done. I mean, he was an amazing man. And I don't want to in any way set aside his moral compass. But the man's sheer genius is something that doesn't get enough discussion as far as I'm concerned.
I think Derek is exactly right. I mean, if you realize that he was doing this in a time when his life was under constant danger, threats, and he was able to fuse so many different issues. I think part of it was because he had a social consciousness that was grounded in theology, in the social gospel.
We're going to have to leave it there. So glad you could join us, gentlemen. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
We've been speaking with Kevin Merida, associate editor of The Washington Post and editor of Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. He joined us from The Washington Post studios. Corey Dade, Atlanta correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with us from the studios of Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. And Derek McGinty, news anchor for WUSA in Washington, D.C. He was at the NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C.